Welcome to the UK Travel Planning Podcast. Your host is the founder of the UK travel planning website, Tracy Collins. In this podcast, Tracy shares destination guides, travel tips, and itinerary ideas, as well as interviews with a variety of guests who share their knowledge and experience of UK travel to help you plan your perfect UK vacation. Join us as we explore the UK from cosmopolitan cities to quaint villages, from historic castles to beautiful islands, and from the picturesque countryside to seaside towns.
Hi, and welcome to episode 88 of the UK Travel Planner Podcast. I'm really excited again this week because I have got Charlotte Gollidge back. Charlotte is from Edinburgh Black Cab Tours, who I spoke to last week. So if you didn't hear that episode, do go back and listen to Charlotte talk all about the company and the tours they do. But I've invited Charlotte back this week because Charlotte has a particular specialism and a particular interest, which when I was chatting to her in preparation for the last podcast, I kind of went, I want to talk more about this. So I'm going to let Charlotte introduce herself and tell her what that is.
But I'm just going to say two words, and those two words are Greyfriars Kirkyard.
So Charlotte, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about this particular area of specialism that you have?
Okay, so obviously, yes, I'm Charlotte Gollidge. I'm one of the four main guides with Edinburgh Black Cab Tours, along with Steve, Stephen and Kevin. But the other thing that I am known as the death historian. And that is because I specialised in death history, mainly 18th century funeral practices for my dissertation. So, but that came off the back of me starting work in Greyfriars and working around Greyfriars for the last 19 years. So I've always had a deep interest in graveyards. The symbology on Scottish Presbyterian graves is absolutely phenomenal. You know, you'll go in and you'll see the skull and crossbones and know it's not pirates and know it's not plague victims, which is often what people say they are. Yeah. It's not. And, you know, growing up with something like that, it's fascinating. I've always had an overactive imagination. So looking at these gravestones, when you can't even see the names anymore, but you can see all the imagery going on, is amazing. So I first of all started working in an information centre. It was basically the information centre that was run by City of the Dead Tours, who do tours of Greyfriars. At one time, they were the only company that went in there, but now there's a multitude of companies who go in. And they all have their different specialities. But I started documenting the gravestones because I noticed like some of them were having, they were degrading basically. Mm. And I thought it would be such a shame. I mean, they've been documented before, but I wanted to do it too. I mean, I was sketching them, I was taking photographs of them. And it was just became like a real passion of mine. We skipped forward through the years and obviously, I did my history degree, then I went and did my master's degree. And when I was deciding on my dissertation, I was kind of speaking about it. And I was like, well, I could do workhouses because that's quite interesting. Or I could do some aspect of Greyfriars because I know so much about it. And pretty much my tutor at the time was like, don't do workhouses. She's like, I see workhouses all the time. So I was like, right, I'm going to do Greyfriars. And I basically went to the National Records of Scotland and I went looking through anything that was connected to Greyfriars. Because the great thing is in Scotland, all records are actually, you know, anybody in the public can look up these records, you know, right back from 400 years ago to like last week. Anyone who's gets married or dies, you know, these records are public records, so anybody can look at them. So I went through a lot of these, not so much the certificates. It was actually some family papers of this gentleman called Thomas Smith. And it was basically his burial record, you know, of all the different things that had to be paid for to have a funeral. And I found it absolutely fascinating. You know, it was everything from gloves that people had to have and what food there was going to be. And then it came down to the two watchmen who were going to be watching the grave. And of course, that comes into the whole body snatching side of things. So from this one document, all of a sudden, this big project, well, project, it was my dissertation, but it's gone further than that now. You know, it's like I spend a lot of time in various graveyards now. I write about them. I wrote about Greyfriars first. I mean, it is actually Greyfriars Kirkyard, but my publisher, yes, being Amberley Publishing, thought that Kirkyard might limit people who would read it. So for everyone in Scotland who are like, it's a kirkyard, yes, I know it's a kirkyard.
I've actually got the book in front of me because I read it today. I find it an absolutely fascinating place to visit. But you have such an in-depth knowledge. And I was reading through the book today and I read the bit about Thomas and about his funeral, which was really interesting. And then the bit about the grave snatchers, I've got a history degree. I knew a little bit about, but wow, absolutely fascinating. So do you know about the history of when Greyfriars began and kind of what the history was over time? And when was the last burial there?
I do know quite a lot of these questions. Yeah. So basically, it was the Grey Friars. That's why it got called Grey Friars. It was the Franciscan monks, and they would wear the grey habits. So they were given the lands there. It was on the outskirts of the city. They were very well known for healing the sick and doing a lot for the community. And then obviously the Reformation happens. The buildings got sacked. The monks got sort of chased off. But they kept the name sort of Greyfriars for the area because they weren't hated by anybody. It's just they were no longer welcome there. So when Mary, Queen of Scots, gifted the land to the people of Edinburgh, because round St Giles, that was at one time this gigantic graveyard that everybody was being buried in from Edinburgh, and it was becoming so overpopulated. So when you're in Edinburgh, walking down the Royal Mile, and you walk around the back of St Giles, you're literally walking on what was once the main burial ground for the city. And it was realised they needed another burial ground. So they used Greyfriars. It was gifted to the city by the Queen. She gave it to them. She also gave one to the people of Dundee, which again was another Greyfriars, although that's known as the Howth in Dundee. So that was gifted as well. And it was for the burial of the dead. Now, the population of Edinburgh started to expand. And so at Greyfriars, it started off as a parish burial ground, which is different from a cemetery. It's a parish burial ground. It's connected to a church. But then they realised they needed a congregation. There was a need for a congregation. So that's when the church came along. The church was then built after the burial ground. So usually you'll have a church first and the burial ground will appear around it. But this was kind of done the opposite way around.
Oh, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. So I know, because I was at St Giles and did that tour, and I know they were kind of saying that at a point when there was lots of rains, that actually bodies were kind of going down the hill, being washed down because there were so many. So they decided then to start burying people in Greyfriars. So I know when you go in Greyfriars today, there's kind of a lot of gravestones and mausoleums and the different ways of kind of marking the burials. But mm-hmm. I know not everybody was buried that way, though. They just started burying people and not marking where they were put?
Well, the thing is, if you were poor, you wouldn't have a gravestone. So after the Reformation had happened, it was no longer considered appropriate to bury people within the churches. That was seen as being very Catholic. So they wanted to get people out into the graveyards. So a lot of the well-to-do would take the areas around the walls so they could have these big mural monuments put up that looked quite similar to the sort of monuments they would have inside the churches. That's why when you go to Greyfriars, like all the walls are, you know, mostly covered in these beautiful big monuments. But if you look in the central areas, there's very few gravestones. And that's because a lot of the poor people were being buried in those areas, couldn't afford a headstone. And when you see the interment records, I mean, some people will be like, let's just say, George MacDonald, and he's buried 5 paces south of the tree. Now, the tree is gone. We do not know where the tree is. There's been various trees. But that's how the interment records were done. And also at the time, people in these areas, they would have known each other, you know. So it wasn't like you had to know a gravestone to know where somebody was. You just knew where they were. And if you had any more family, you'd probably want them put there. But if you were poor, you wouldn't really have much choice in the matter, you know. You had to rely on your parish to bury you. And I mean, at one time in Scotland, if you were very poor, you didn't even have to have a coffin. You know, you had to be wrapped, but you didn't need a coffin. And some graveyards in Scotland, they formed societies where they actually would buy a communal coffin. So you'd be carried along the streets in your coffin. get to the gravesite, and then basically a trapdoor would open, the body would drop inside. So it's all been very, very dignified until you get to the last part. But in Scotland, the actual burial part was not part of the ceremony. The ceremony was when you died, people would come to the house, and it was called a lie wake. And that's while you're lying there, the wake is happening all the time. So when you see like there's bottles of whiskey, there's cake and everything like that, because if you don't have enough to give your visitors, then it was seen that you were not honouring your dead properly. The day of the funeral would come round. So everybody would come in to say their goodbyes. And at that point, the women would no longer be involved in it. They were seen as being too emotional. So they wouldn't go along the procession usually. And the procession was usually done. You'd have the mutes at the front. And if you've ever watched Oliver Twist, obviously Oliver gets sent out to the undertakers and you see him and he's got like the hat and the big ribbon all coming down. You'd have the baton men who would walk at the sides with the batons. They didn't go around hitting anybody, but, you know, that was to get clear people out the way so the walking funeral would come through. You might have the man with the bell at the front, with the deed bell, and he would just be ringing it to basically let people know that there's a funeral coming through. And if you were from the great and the good, I mean, these walking funerals could stretch on for a good couple of miles, you know, as people were joining them as they were going along. And then once you got to the gravesite, it was kind of, that's it. You know, you wouldn't even necessarily have a minister there. You know, it was like that was the end of it. You just got there, got buried, and
that was it.
Well, that was it for most people. Obviously, that's the point that the body snatchers would come along and be like, we have a nice fresh body here. So quite often you would see the landed and the rich, they would pay for watchmen to come and basically watch the grave. Now, the problem with these watchmen is they're not getting paid very much. Yet, if they have a fresh body that they can take to the anatomy schools, they can get about £8, £9, £10, which is basically almost like a year's salary for them. So what's even better is you're getting paid to watch a grave that you've dug up, you've moved the body, and then you're just sat there, like, watching it, and you already know the body's gone. Because at the time, in Edinburgh, if you read the newspapers, it's like it wasn't happening. Nobody talked about it. It wasn't in the newspapers. But if you read things like the Liverpool Echo, or you read some of the London Illustrated News, everything like that, and they're talking about these barrels of brine being found in Leith, where they'd been shipped up from London, they'd been shipped up from Liverpool with bodies in them. In London, there was the Ben Crouch gang, and they went around the cemeteries of London and they were digging up bodies and actually sending them up to Edinburgh because the demand was so high. And if you were a very poor student, you just needed a body. So it didn't matter if it was like a month or so old, you still needed it.
I read they had to have three bodies while they studied to be a doctor. So, and that was kind of the early 19th century, late 18th century.
I mean, this comes in from, you know, the 18th century, you know, this goes right back. This book I've got here is the Royal College of Surgeons, 1505 to 1905. And that's like all the surgeons, and all these surgeons would have needed bodies at one time. And in Scotland, basically, the only body you could legally use is if someone had been convicted of usually murder and they were sentenced to death, but part of their punishment would then be dissection. Now, the Presbyterian belief was your body needed to stay intact. So when you die, I mean, obviously the Catholic faith has one view, the Episcopalian faith has another view, and both those views do not need the body. The body is merely your vessel. But the Presbyterians of that time believed that when you died, your soul was instantly released and went up to heaven. So that's when you see like the little faces with the wings on them. That is actually the representation of the soul. And the soul is completely innocent of your free will. That's your body. That's you that has the free will, and it's you that can sin. So your soul goes straight off to heaven. It's fine up there. Then when the day of judgment comes along, the angels of the resurrection will blow their trumpets, and your body, if you've been good and it's deemed that you can go up, your body will rise out of the ground, go up to heaven, and you'll live this eternal life of happiness and joy because you've had such a harsh life on earth and you've been very good and you've had no fun and you've just praised God and worked. So that's basically going to be your prize when you get up there.
Yes.
But if you have a body that's been tampered with and it's been dissected, there's no body to go up there to join it. So while it wasn't a crime, to have a body, dig up a body. Morally, it was very wrong, and societies really weren't happy about it. And you go through all these different records and you actually see people saying, oh, we were there to make sure the student stayed away. You know, we were guarding the grave and, you know, for a certain amount of time. And this is all in people's private letters that are in the National Records for Scotland. But you look at the newspapers, there's nothing. There's nothing mentioning this at all. And in fact, you can actually read some of the advertisements by the anatomy schools where they're bragging about having daily autopsies so people could go along and watch the anatomy classes, and one of them being Dr. Robert Knox. Now, the difference with Dr. Robert Knox was he was having these classes that people could attend in the summer. Now, usually, you wouldn't want bodies that smell of decay. Well, he must have been getting fresh bodies from
somewhere. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And in comes Burke and Hare. So Burke and Hare did not dig up bodies. You know, they were not grave, you know, they were technically body snatchers because they were snatching bodies that were still living and they killed them.
Right.
But they were not, they weren't stealing from the grave. They weren't digging anybody up. So, you know, often they weren't resurrectionists. And that's the term usually used for the people that resurrect the body out of the ground. They're the resurrectionists. They were not resurrectionists. Technically, they could be body snatchers.
And it wasn't in the papers, the fact that people were, if they had the money, were building bars around where they were being buried or having guards on. They kind of knew that that was going to be a risk when they died, didn't they? Mm-hmm. So it was kind of well known, even though they weren't kind of publicising it.
It was very well known. I mean, there is one surgeon who's buried in Greyfriars, and you see his enclosure, and he's got big gates on the front of his enclosure, and he's got big bars on the top. And he died in the 1700s. And if a surgeon is doing that sort of thing to his grave, he knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so these are known as mort safes. So it's basically to protect the dead so they can basically putrefy enough that they cannot no longer be used by the anatomy schools. And when you get out of Edinburgh, I mean, it wasn't just Edinburgh. The bodies were getting taken from everywhere. If you come over to Fife, obviously, it's just like a little boat, well, it's quite a big boat ride, but, you know, if you're rowing across the Forth with these bodies, you know, we have Old Rosyth that has a mort house, which if you were part of the society and paid into it, when you died, your body was put in there, it was guarded in there until the point where your body would no longer be useful, then it was buried. And you would have, like, other parishes would have mort stones. So they would use these massive stones to put over the grave. So, again, they think it would be safe. However, body snatchers or resurrectionists, they didn't, like, dig a nice hole to open up a whole coffin worth. They would usually dig right down at the head. They would get rope around it and they would pull the body out from one end. A few years ago, I was actually involved with the young archaeologists in Dunfermline. And a couple of the graves, because they were actually excavating down into the grave areas, because it's like finding all sorts of artifacts that came along. People used it as a dump. And a couple of the graves that we came across had big stone slabs that kind of went, you know, near the head end and near the foot end, but not in the middle. Because obviously, if you went down the middle, you can't pull the body out from the middle. It has to come from one end or the other. Yeah. So people were doing that. People would also put big branches inside the graves, so, you know, it's harder to get through the branches to get to the bodies. There were so many ways that people were trying to do these things, and especially poor people, because they couldn't afford to do these things. I mean, there were a lot of watch houses were put in, so people could sit in these watch houses. And unfortunately, a lot of these things came into play very, very close to the end of the body snatching, because after Burke and Hare had done their thing. And down in London, there was a case known as the Italian Boy. This was all happening at about the same time.
Yeah.
The 1832 Anatomy Act came in, and basically it made a lot more bodies available. It also made it illegal for you to tamper with a grave, you know, so all these things came into play. But in Greyfriars, you actually see there's a couple of graves that still have, well, one in particular has a mort safe, and the date on it is well after 1832. So obviously people were still worried about these sort of things happening. And again, it's, you know, it's your loved ones, but it's not just the fact it's your loved ones. It's the fact you might never get to see them on the day of judgment when you're up in heaven and they're not there because somebody's chopped you up. But on the other side of things, Edinburgh was such a leading place for medical studies. And we probably wouldn't have been as advanced as fast as we were in Scotland without these people. Mm-hmm. So while on one side of it, it's a very gruesome and hard thing to get your head around, on the other side of it is it made Edinburgh this leading establishment for medical studies. So
it's a fact of the kind of history of Greyfriars that happened, and the history of Edinburgh. And I don't think you can't talk about Greyfriars without talking about the reality of what it was like in those times as well. But there's a couple of other things with Greyfriars that I can't have to mention. And obviously one is the Harry Potter connection. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see why J.K. Rowling would have got the inspiration, and you know, some of the names potentially. I don't know if she's actually said that she's got the names from there, or if that's just a kind of
more recently she has been claiming that she didn't get the names from there. She I think last year on Twitter she decided to have a moment where she said that no, she didn't get the names from there. I mean, she did explain away some of the names, you know. Scrimmager is actually part of Thomas Smith's family, you know, and that's Earl of Dundee's family, you know, the Scrimmagers and the Wedderburns. Yes. Probably going to say she'd probably got McGonagall, if I'm honest, because McGonagall is a Dundee name. Well, it came from Ireland, really. But, you know, there's still the McGonagall family from William McGonagall, who is the poet. And obviously, you know, Professor McGonagall is there. She's so far removed from William McGonagall, the poet. It's unbelievable. And I mean, some people do say about Thomas Riddle, but there's actually an enclosure quite close to the front gate of Greyfriars, and it's the Riddell family that are there. So I'm a little bit dubious that she travelled all the way through the graveyard to find this very small, well, reasonably small grave marker on a wall. And decided, yes, that's the one I'm going to use, especially as it's Riddell, not Riddle. You have Riddle's Court, you know, so there's other connections that she could have got the names elsewhere, but you know what? It's stuck. It's stuck. Yes. And it's just become another part of the tapestry of the history of Greyfriars, is how I like to say it. Once upon a time, there would have been people very upset that people were coming in and wanting to visit a little dog. And then having a gravestone for a little dog would have been very inappropriate at one time, and people would have been very upset about that. But it brought people in. And again, with Harry Potter, whether she took the inspiration from there or not, it has become part of the folklore of Greyfriars. It's there to stay. You don't have to like it, but you know what? Just don't go in. You know, yeah, don't listen to it. Don't go in. It's as simple as that.
You've actually touched on the second kind of obvious connection, which I had to bring up, which of course is Greyfriars Bobby. And you walk into Greyfriars, and right in front of you is Greyfriars Bobby's grave, where he's buried. And obviously there's the little statue on the wall before you get into Greyfriars itself. But the story of Greyfriars Bobby, because I think obviously a lot of people know that because, there's been a movie made of it. So it's kind of the folklore around Greyfriars Bobby. It was interesting because I was reading your book today about some people now deny that there was ever a dog, but there seems to have been evidence from newspapers at the time that there was a dog. But that's a lovely story.
It's a very lovely story. And now the one that most people know about was written by Eleanor Aitkenson, who was actually an American. She'd never been to Scotland. She was an English teacher. And it's quite obvious from her very good grasp of the dialect is that she must have spoken to a lot of Scottish migrants who had left Edinburgh. You know, they'd gone there and she heard this story. Because the story of it being an old shepherd, that's the one that she wrote about, and it's more likely to have been John Gray, the watchman. The thing is that from the newspaper reports, you know, we have when Bobby was taken up because he didn't have his license. We actually have like the London Illustrated News. There are newspaper reports that did say that Bobby existed. In one form or another, there was this little dog who captured the imagination and the heart of all these people. There's a photograph of Mr. Trail and his family with Bobby. I mean, okay, Bobby seems to change a little bit over the years. So, you know, we don't know enough to certainly say it was the same dog the whole time. But we can certainly say there was a dog that got people thinking. And obviously the fountain that's outside, it was Baroness Coutts who had that created. And she was one of the patrons of the RSPCA at the time. So obviously in Scotland, we have the SSPCA now. But at that time, it was the RSPCA. And she paid for that fountain to be put there. At the bottom, you have the basically for dogs to drink from. Then you have the bird bath, and then there used to be little cups on it so humans could drink from it as well. And unfortunately, Bobby, whichever Bobby, the Bobby that that statue comes from, he died before the fountain was completed. And sometimes tour guides will say to you that it was turned around the other way. It wasn't. It's always been that way. Nobody has turned it round. It's the way it always has been. But you know what? The legend of Bobby, people are still talking about him. And I mean, I don't agree with every story I hear people say about him, but they're talking about him. They're keeping this little dog alive in people's minds. And that's the same with Greyfriars. I often say to people, even just by reading people's names, you're bringing back these people who wanted to be remembered, or people who wanted them to be remembered. And you know what? As much as I don't like it, so what if people go looking for Lord Voldemort and they stand at Captain Thomas Riddell's grave? Because you know what? It might not be the way he wanted to be remembered, but people are still reading his name. They're bringing him back, even if they're not thinking about him themselves.
That's the fabric of Greyfriars, isn't it? I think the thing is as well, is that this is all of the fabric of the history of Edinburgh. And you can't, to me, if you're going to Edinburgh, you will feel the history of Edinburgh just walking down the Royal Mile. You will feel it everywhere. But understanding it and learning a bit about it, whether it's the stories or the experience of actually going in Greyfriars, having a look around, mm-hmm. feeling the whole history of the area, and
just trying to understand a little bit of what it was like for people living in Edinburgh hundreds of years ago.
And one of the good things is, the other thing I should really mention, I'm actually the current chair of the Friends of Greyfriars Kirkyard as well. I can't get away from the place. So people don't need to be able to go to Edinburgh to join that. You can actually join to be one of the Friends of Greyfriars Kirkyard. And members can, they can pay anything from £5, £20, because we don't want to keep it from anybody. In fact, our current vice chair, she's actually in America, because we set this up during COVID. So that's why our deputy chair, Lexi, she's over there in America. So, you know, there's people from all over the world who can get such a love of Greyfriars. And there's going to be some fantastic projects. We did do a guidebook, which was a community-based project, which got a lot of people involved, people who are interested in Greyfriars. But then we also managed to get some of the local community, people who have lived and grown up around Greyfriars. They see that as their garden, basically. And so they have a very different relationship with it as well. Quite often, I've chatted to a lot of local residents. And it's lovely in the summer. You see people having picnics, and it's a lovely area. And there's so many people that it's so special to them for, and for very, very different reasons. And none of these reasons are wrong. There's not a wrong reason to love Greyfriars or to have a connection with it. But I think we all feel like it belongs to us because it's so special to us all. So it can be a difficult one sometimes. But by getting involved with the Friends of Greyfriars, it gives you a voice. You can give an opinion on things. And with those voices, we can pass those on to the council. We can pass those on to Edinburgh World Heritage. And it's just a way for people to, you know, take care of it. Even if we can't actually do much, we can document, we can try and just save things, even researching people, bringing those people back again just for a little while. You know, it's a really lovely thing to do.
Oh, I totally agree, Charlotte. And I'll just mention your book as well, which I spent this afternoon reading, which was fascinating. It was great, which is called Greyfriars Graveyard. Mm-hmm. So I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. And also the link for Greyfriars for people to join through the website. That'd be great. We can put that in. I'm going to end the podcast. I'll say thanks so much for talking about it. It's just fascinating. Honestly, I could talk to you for hours about this, and I know people are going to be really interested. And I would, you know, recommend when you go to Edinburgh, do pop over to Greyfriars and have a look around. So I'm going to ask you the one question that I ask at the end of every episode. So I did that last week, and this week I'm going to say, what would be your one word of advice, one tip you would give to somebody visiting Edinburgh for the first time? And also you could say somebody visiting Greyfriars for the first time.
Well, obviously I would say get this fantastic book.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be honest, as much as I'm saying that, there is actually, I go into all the symbology. So if you want to know why there's a skull and crossbone, you want to know why there's an hourglass, you want to know why there's certain flowers, that's all in there. And you can use that in any Presbyterian graveyard. It doesn't just have to be Greyfriars. So you can use that. Another piece of advice I would give people, if you're going to Greyfriars, go in the church. You know, go in the church. They have a wonderful museum in there, and it goes all into about how the National Covenant was signed. It does a little bit about Bobby. And in fact, inside the church in the museum, we actually have the remains of Bobby II, as we call him, who is the little dog who was in the 1952 Greyfriars Bobby. That little dog is in a little casket that was made from one of the trees that came down. He'd been buried near Lasswade. And basically the family who had taken on the star, Bobby, he was buried there. And then they found out that there's housing going to be built. So the great nephew, he spent nearly 2 years trying to find where Bobby was buried, found Bobby. They were able to cremate him. He was put in his casket. He was then gifted to the bereavement services at Edinburgh City Council. And Edinburgh City Council have put him on long-term loan to the Kirk. So you can actually go in and learn the story about the little dog that played Bobby. Aww. And he's there as well now. So,
oh, well, I have to say, I'm going to put my hand up and say at this point, I actually have not been inside the Kirk. I've actually been at the Greyfriars, but I haven't actually been inside. So I will do that next time, Charlotte. So thanks so much for that tip. So thanks again for coming on to the podcast. We know we're going to schedule an episode soon to talk about Outlander. Mm-hmm. So if you're an Outlander fan, you need to keep an eye out for when that episode's coming out, because that's going to be an exciting episode. So thanks so much for coming on again.
Thank you so much, Tracy, and we'll speak again soon.
Well, that was another absolutely fantastic episode with Charlotte. Remember that Charlotte is one of the private driver tour guides with Edinburgh Black Cab Tours. So you can always meet Charlotte and the gang if you book a tour with them. I just want to remind you that the show notes for this episode, with the links to everything Charlotte and I talked about, including Charlotte's excellent book about Greyfriars, will be in this week's show notes at uktravelplanet.com/episode88 as usual. That just leaves me to say, until next week's episode, happy UK travel planning. Thank you.